Accession number 11939, Rule 6.
Mr. John Williams, Reel 6. We were discussing the training, and particularly the aspect of training which seemed to be geared very much to the First World War, Mr. Williams. How accurate was this statement?
Yes, I think it was, really. But as we did have General Martel, who was supposed to be a useful tank man, and he was our divisional commander, because we didn't realise at the time. But he seemed to be younger, but there was an awful lot of old greyheads there. And of course, some aspects, when I look back now, because a lot of this is with hindsight, you see, but we were trained, we had anti-tank rifles, boys' anti-tank rifles, which fired a solid, something like these rounds are firing in Northern Ireland at the moment, you know. And you know, there was a tendency to say, if you don't hold it properly, it'll break your shoulder. So don't fire it. There was a general sort of suggestion, and that was emanating from people who were training and so on. And I never fired an anti-tank round until much later in the war.
What did the boy's rifle look like?
It was a very stout-looking rifle, heavy, and it had about three or four times the size of an ordinary rifle round. And it did have a very strong kick. If you let it go slack, it could jump back. And I don't quite know what it was supposed to do. How you were expected to knock an armoured vehicle out, I don't know. On the other hand, mine would be all right for dealing with Wren carriers, because it is an actual fact that you could puncture the wall of a Wren carrier with an ordinary 303 round. So that I think the idea, or the devout hope, was that if any of the tank tracks were exposed, that hitting it with this heavy, solid round, it wasn't explosive, it was just solid cast iron, you might break a track or something like that. But quite honestly, what the devil use it was, I don't. And very, very heavy.
Was there any confidence in the weapon?
No. And the funny thing was, the people who trained us used to emphasise, I thought unduly, the possibility that you might break your shoulder if you didn't hold it properly. Well, you tell a young soldier that, start away from it. He won't have any confidence in it. On the other hand, although we had young soldiers, all of us had fired the ordinary 303. We had, and I'd taken part in my territorial existence in Territorial Army Rifle Association meetings and so on, and I wasn't a bad shot, actually, and I had great confidence in my rifle. I remember one of the things that used to, I used to be very sharp with recruits when they used to say they were pulling the trigger. You don't bloody well pull the trigger, you press it, I used to say, you know. And teach them to take the first pressure when they came up, you know, that sort of thing. And I had great confidence in the rifle for killing men, but I didn't have much confidence in the anti-tank rifle for doing anything to armoured vehicles.
How did you feel about the quality of marksmanship with the rifle within your company and battalion?
Well, as the majority of our people, there were young ones who joined in 1939, but an awful lot of our blokes were old soldiers. And it wasn't too bad, you know. There were some quite good shots among them. And there was a little bit of pride, you know, in their shooting. But the other thing, some of us had been brought up on the Lewis gun, you know, which was a First World War weapon. And again, derogatory statement. The Bren guns, which were issued to us in 38 and 39, they were too accurate. We wished we still had the old Lewis gun back, because you got a bit of spread when you fired it, you know. And so there was something derogatory about Bren guns at that stage. With the old, you know, when we used to fire on the range, when we used to fire the Lewis gun, in competition, I remember, somewhere in the 6th Battalion, there'd be a cup with my Corporal Williams on, you know. But you had the target there at 400 yards. and there were some iron plates on the ground, and you had a limited number of rounds in your magazine, and you had to clink one of these plates, which you could hear very, before you were allowed to turn onto the... So the more ammunition you expended on hitting a plate, the less you had to go into the target, you know what I mean? And we used to rather like the Lewis gun because it had a little spread. We said, this Bren gun, it's like a rifle, it's too direct. It just hits what you're aiming at. It doesn't spread and kill any more men around about it, you know? When I look back now, that boy's anti-tank rifle and the Bren gun, they weren't precisely popular with some of us older territories. Now, later on, after, in December 40, I went to the Army School of Musketry, and I achieved an entirely different attitude there. But that was just the beginning of the war. All very naive at the time, but still.
What was the complement of Bren guns to the section and platoon?
There were four sections. One was a rifle section, two were a rifle section, and two were Bren gun. So they had there were two Bren guns in a platoon. And then there was an anti-tank gun dragged in somewhere in the platoon.
Was this the boys or...?
The boys anti-tank rifle, sorry. A 1.3 gun. Because at that stage we didn't have the 6-pounder. We didn't have the 6-pounder.
So a platoon had one boys anti-tank rifle?
A platoon had one boys anti-tank rifle. And two Bren guns. And the rest were riflemen. And bayonet men, you know.
What other weapons were you...
We still had the old 18-inch bayonet as well, I should tell you.
What other weapons were you using or about to use at this time? Mortars, for example. With mortars?
We were issued with a small 2-inch mortar, which was fired by turning a wheel, you know, and it sprang and fired a mortar bomb, which was very, very small sort of job, you know. But it had this advantage, you know. Later on, I became an aficionado of the 3-inch mortar. I loved that. I really did love the 3-inch mortar. And I was a mortar officer and so on. The thing is, with all mortars and so on, there's a certain moral advantage. I mean, take it at its simplest. If you see a very small child out and it starts to thunder, put the hand over the head. Because the head... The human being knows the head is a very weak part of the body, even a small child. Now, when a shell screams at you, low trajectory, you can hear it coming. But a mortar bomb goes right up in the end, down like that. And people hate mortars. They're a morale weapon as much as... Of course, a 3-inch mortar could also inflict casualties 100 yards each side of the burst. But the 2-inch mortar, again, that was a small gap weapon, which... I don't think it was worth the carrying around with us, you know. Again, that's just a personal point of view.
Do you have ammunition with it?
There was ammunition, but we weren't allowed to use it. I think we once went to the ranges in an awful long period of time, but we didn't waste ammunition on learning how to shoot. You see, there must have been some juniors who joined us in the last few years. Last few days of night in August, some of these lads, you know, there was a stage there when they were told that if they joined the Territorial Army, they wouldn't be called up into the militia. So the one or two came in, very late stage. Some of those lads mustn't have fired a shot, never mind in anger, in practice, for quite some considerable time after they joined the Army.
Hand grenades, did you have hand grenades?
We knew what they were. But I never threw a hand grenade. I never threw a hand grenade, a real one which burst, until after I'd come back from France. We'd seen them in the box, because we never got near enough to the enemy in France to throw hand grenades at them. And I knew the weight of them and so on. And we had dummies which we used to throw, you know, to give us the... Because they were reasonably heavy, 1 pound in weight, and you had to throw them quite a distance. But I never saw one.
There were never in sufficient supply for you to use in practice? Oh,
no, no, not, no, I never practiced. The only time I practiced them was in, after Dunkirk.
Anti-gas training, Mr. Williams, what form did that take?
It was very, very sketchy. We knew there were two types of gas, there were asphyxiating gas, and there was the burning gas, like mustard gas, which raised blisters on you. And then we knew that it produced an arsenical gas, which gave you a bad throat and reduced your morale. But we just knew that. And we didn't have any gas. We knew we were fairly slick in putting our respirators on. But you see, the point was, I don't think people knew that a respirator was effective. You knew how to put it on. And you went around and tightened it. And sometimes you held the pipe tight as a sergeant to see whether... And then if they push your hand away, you knew they weren't getting any air through, you know, that they were working that respect. But very little. See, I was very lucky. I got to the gas school in October. And I got a Q1, which was a fairly high mark in my training. But even then, I came back a Q1, and they didn't use me for ages. You know?
And what form of training did you take on this course, this gas course?
Oh, well, we were gassed. This arsenical gas, I forget what its name was now, it used to reduce your morale. It burned your throat and just reduced your morale. And the only cure for it, they used to tell you, was a glass of whiskey or a drink.
And you were deliberately gassed with this?
We're deliberately gassed with this stuff, and all the canteens were closed, so we couldn't go and get a drink to cheer ourselves up. So we experienced the fullness of it. Comparatively small amount. And then our respirators were tested with tear gas. It was there also I learned a trick which I played on some of our men later. You went in, you put your respirator on and went into a sealed off space full of tear gas, you know. And the instructor talked to you in a muffled tone. Said, everything all right? Where you shaved, you felt a little bit soreness, you know, right? But otherwise it was all right. And then he used to take his respirator off. I say, well, now, when I give you the word, I want you to take your respirator off so you can see how effective the respirator is. Now, what we didn't know, I discovered later when I put several hundreds of people through them, that your eyes became slightly immune to tear gas. So you could take your respirator off and talk. Of course, everybody watching like that, they thought, well, this respirator is no bloody good, you know. And so when he said, right, remove respirator, took them up, then they all stuck it away at the end, and eyes streaming, you know. And they couldn't understand. And I'd say, there, now, effective, wasn't it? I'd say, yeah. And they used to look at you, you know, because after a while, after two or three tries, the tear gas didn't affect your eyes, you know, if you were an instructor. And we were shown, we weren't blistered with mustard gas, but we were shown pictures of mustard gas burns, you know.
So the authorities obviously thought that there would be gas.
Oh, yes, they were quite sure. And you see, there again you get it. That presupposes static warfare, doesn't it? Because the Germans used gas in the following wind and so on in 1915 against the 50th Division. Right? But they used it and against the Canadians because they were in a sort of static position. Now, in the war, we never used gas. You know, later on.
How long did your course last?
It was 3 weeks.
And do you recall the time of the year that this course took place?
October. And it was at the Army Gas School, Fort Tregantle. And it was very well conducted, good and cuts. And I really enjoyed it. You know, it was a new thing and so on. And I felt I was doing something useful. And I must have, because a Q1, qualification class one, is a good mark, you know.
And you returned to the battalion?
Returned to the battalion after that.
As a platoon sergeant?
As a platoon sergeant. And there'd be an entry put somewhere in my records, attended Gasco Q1, but I wasn't called upon to do any. I used to shout at the blokes and tell them my experience and so on, and tell them how good the respirators were and all that sort of thing, my particular circle. But it wasn't until we came back from France when we had Colonel Percy, the Black Prince, slightly lame man who was RCO. He said, we used to have to give lectures, and I was giving a lecture once about gas. And Colonel Percy came in the back. And then when I'd finished talking, he got hold of the company commander and said, why the hell isn't this man doing some testing of respirators and training and so on? He seems to know the subject. Why the bloody hell aren't you using it properly? So after that, I had a pillbox blocked off and I was putting all the battalion through gas and so on. But that was after Dunkirk, you know.
You've mentioned some tactics in field techniques and so on. What other kind of tactics was the battalion being trained to do at this stage of the war? You mentioned debussing and...
Yes, advancing in open order and doing a final bayonet charge about 30, 40, 50 yards at the end and that sort of thing. That literally was a tactic, you know.
Were you involved in any way with other arms of the services, the artillery, RAF?
No, we knew the artillery and sometimes to follow up, but we sometimes passed through guns which weren't firing, you know. We didn't liaise at all with the Royal Air Force. There were some mysterious people who flew fighters up above, you know, that sort of thing. And it was really, and of course there was no parachute regiment in those days.
Tanks? Did you have any liaison with tanks?
No, no.
No tank training at all?
No tank training, no. It was, we could have slipped into Sir John Moore's command in 1805 and he wouldn't have noticed any difference, except we were wearing khaki uniform, you know.
Knowing now what came later in France, how would you judge your training?
Well, it didn't do any harm, it didn't do any good, because the Blitzkrieg was so effective that we didn't have any tanks to sort of talk about. We were supported by French who had cavalry horses, and so the whole thing, our tactics made no difference to the German advance, you know. Except, in fact, the only advantage we gained was the fact that Hitler had been a First World soldier, and he knew the British infantry of the 1418 war and respected them. And so I sometimes think he held back from we poor characters, if he'd only known, but he held back because we were British, you know. I think that was the main thing, you know.
How long were you down in there, the south England, south west England?
Well, we went down there and we were there, and in early January we went across to France, but we were there.
Did you meet? Not personally, of course, but did the battalion meet any of the famous people at that time? Churchill, the King?
No. The King inspected us once, but I wasn't there. At one stage, and I forget precisely the date, there was an officer's school at Bourton-on-the-Water, and I was sent to act as quartermaster there. I was doing clerical work and so on, and the only thing that happened to me once, there was an officer, a major, and I think he was a lawyer, in the 6th Battalion, elderly bloke, First World War man, wish I could remember his name, and I was working in the office, and I cleaned my shoes and cleaned my buttons, I still didn't have battle dress, but I didn't put my puttees on because I was doing office work, and I got a monument bollocking for them. Why aren't you properly dressed, Sergeant? I said, I'm sorry, sir, as I was doing clerk. You're in the bloody arm, right, get back. Return to your billet and get your putties on in the proper fashion and return here. So I thought to put my putties on and come back. And I didn't feel any objection to him. I thought he's probably quite right. I was still in the stage when I thought to be a soldier still. But he gave me a real rollicking. I forget his name now. The 6th Battalion man.
How did you feel when the time for embarkation came, moving away to France? What were your feelings?
Again, feeling of adventure, you know. Because we came from Southampton. And strange enough, if I may sidetrack, I saw a show on the BBC the other night showing these little Jewish children who'd been evacuated from Germany being brought across from Holland on an LNER steamer called the SS Prague. Well, that was a ship we went across from Southampton to Cherbourg, to Prague. It was a Hook of Holland, you know, Harwich Hook of Holland LNER steamer.
Do you recall the move?
Not particularly. We went down by train, took all our kit, marched down to the docks and got aboard the steamer. It was comparatively short crossing.
And the date was when?
Well, it was early January. Early January 1940.
The people that you had been with, the civilians that you had they any notion that you were going abroad? But when it actually happened, was there any kind of sending off?
No. We slipped away. I haven't got the slightest doubt, I knew pretty well, you know. But it was in one of those, I must relate this. I've told you about Captain George Leslie Wood. He had me once, said, "Oh, Sergeant Williams, could I have your advice?" I said, "Yes, sir." Well, we had a bit of a rapscallion, in fact, a horrible type, who picked a dose of VD up. And he'd been to the Army Hospital at Netley with VD. And he was alleged to be cured. And he'd come back to battalion just before we left. And he said, "How do you feel, Sergeant? Do you think this man is fit enough to go abroad with the battalion? Do you think we should accept him into the battalion when he's been such a bloody fool as to get VD? He's supposed to be cured." But I often wonder about these things. I said, "Yes, sir. Why the hell should he escape foreign service just because he's a bloody fool and undisciplined in his sex life? Let him come with us." He said, "I think you're probably right, son." We took him. Now, as we proceed, I'll tell you how he had a big effect on my life, that character.
Was VD an offence?
Yes, it was. They got pay stopped and all sorts of things, you know. But it was such an unusual thing, you know. I mean, he was the first man I'd ever seen who had VD, you know, and in those days I didn't know. I don't even know what sort of what. I don't know whether it was syphilis or gonorrhea or what he had. But he was a complete lecher, you know.
Prior to going abroad, had you leave? Did you come home on leave?
Yes, we had leave, but not embarkation leave as such. We had leave around about Christmas time, I think it was. But we just said, we wrote separate plans. Well, next time I write to you, I'll probably be overseas. Because we didn't even know we were going to France. We had a pretty good idea, but we might well have been going to India, only they hadn't dished us with any tropical kit.
How did your parents feel towards you on this leave?
Well, they were glad to see us and so on, but I don't know. I think, my mother would say things, "Now you will be careful, won't you, you know?" And once she said, "Don't shoot any of those poor German boys, will you?" "Not unless they shoot me first," Mama said. But there is a valuable sort of situation. Sometime at the end of October, we were issued with the battle dress. And away went all our regimentals and no sign of DLI. And I had just 3 stripes on there. And I had no collar dogs and no buttons to polish and so on. We felt as though we'd slipped down the social gear, although we'd been looking forward to it, you know. And then our cheese cutter hats, you know, were taken away, and we had the... And the thing there was we had to there was a tendency on the part of all soldiers to put the hat on one side with a ricochet. The light infantry had to have their hats on straight with the 2 buttons straight in the middle of the bridge of the nose, you know. And we were continuously, "What regiment do you belong, lad? And get your bloody hat on straight," you know. We had an awful job to get them, because as soon as they got talking to a girl, they cocked a hat on.
But when you went home, and obviously you saw friends and people in your own neighbourhood that you worked with and grown up with, what was their attitude, or what was your attitude towards them?
Well, I just don't know. I remember one incident. Although I hadn't been working in concert officers then, I had a lot of friends up there, and when I was on leave, I went up to see some of them. And I was talking to one chap called Philip something rather. Now, he'd been a very great chapel lad and so on, and he was a conscientious objector. And one of the managers came to me and said, "Don't talk to him. He's a bloody disgrace to the country. He's a conscientious objector." Now, I never liked this boss, and he wasn't my boss any longer. So I said, "Mr. So-and-so, one of the things we're fighting for is freedom of conscience. And I'll bloody well talk to him if I feel like it." Because Philip said, "You'd better leave me. Anyway, he later served as a ambulance man, you know, pretty good soldier. But that was the only time I...
There were no feelings of seeing men of your own age who were still civilians, and no feelings of being in the army?
No. Rather, we felt sorry for them, you know. We were having such a good time, and we were being soldiers, and all the girls thought we were smart and handsome and that sort of thing. And these poor soldiers were still working the pit and working the office. No, that's it. It went. The only thing I noticed particularly was there were various of our contemporaries who suddenly developed asthma and things which we'd never known them have before. One or two of them said, "I wish I was fit enough to join up, you know." Well, not as fit as I was, really, but it's human nature. Anyhow, who would want men like that in a battalion?
Going abroad, what was the morale of the battalion?
Quite high, very high. And the fact we were going to France, where a lot of our relatives and parents and so on, not in my case, but my uncle had been a company commander in the Durham, and we thought we were going to the magic place of France, you know. And we landed at Cherbourg, and I remember some of my contemporaries said, "You can talk French, can't you?" I said, "Yeah." So we went down, and there was a stall with sort of gas lamps, you know, flickering gas, selling oranges. And I said, "Combien des oranges, madame?" And she told me. I said, "There's so much." We'd had some francs on the small. I think we were allowed to.
We'd given French money when we went.
We weren't allowed to have more than 10 shillings of our pay in French money. It was a thing to do. And again, I'll come back. We went down there, and we went down the road, and there were some brothels doing a fundraiser. And one of those blokes said, "Is that one of them places? What would Gannon in? You can talk the lasses, can't you?" I said, "Yes, we went in." And there was this usual garish sort of thing. I remember there was a big wench with a silsier with a blue, short blue dress on, miniskirt, which I'd never seen a woman wear, came and sat on my knee and said, "Hey, soldier, English soldier, you like nice girl." And I bought her a drink, you know. And she said, "You come upstairs with me." There was a big central stairs, and there was a long trek of soldiers coming up and going down. And there were some of our blokes. "Hey, they're all right, these aren't they?" I said, "Yeah, yes." And I think, And this girl was still sort of playing with my hat, you know, and then patting my face. "You like nice girl, nice French girl," and so on. And I thought to myself, I wonder what it's like. And I bought her an absinthe. She wanted an absinthe. And I said to her, "Absinthe, c'est pas bon pour les demoiselles." She said, "No, but it is good for making love." And I was looking at the stairs, and coming down the stairs, who but this character who had had VD? And I looked at that lad, and I thought, right, Williams, you nearly went upstairs with this wench. Now you know he might still have VD. You don't know any of these other characters. So I said, "Allez, fini." I always remember her charm turner. She said, "If you'll excuse the thing, you fuck off, you no fucking bon," and went away. And so I remained moral for the rest of my army life. So this character did me a good turn. If I hadn't insisted, but George says it would have, it should come out, I wouldn't have seen them and come to a very rapid conclusion. But
so arriving in Cherbourg, you had time to do this?
Oh, yes, yes, because we were going on a train after that, and we had time off before the train. Of course, everybody had to be back for the train. We were rounding up and so on. Because they had the squads out with pickhells, sergeants with steel helmets and pickhells, right? Belt any of these lads who didn't, or the sergeant didn't do it, but the other ranks did. And we went down into Normandy.
What were your first impressions of France on the day that you set foot in the country?
Well, I was surprised to see these flaring lights on the storm. And there was no blackout, not the blackout the enforcers such as we had. And nobody seen. There were some kids there, said, as we were going down, "Ici France, vous Anglais, allez." And that's what I said. The kids said, "This is France, you Englishmen, go away." The cheeky little buggers. But, I thought, to say, Cherbourg seemed to be an awful lot of light showing, you know, and all these brothels and bars and so on had lights on and the windows, you know, no blackout. And when we got down into Normandy, a place called Fresne-sur-Sarthe, the River Sarthe, S-A-R-T-H-E, I don't think there was a war on, you know. Everybody was quite nice, Normandy peasants and so on. There was a wench there, a widow she turned out to be, who was running a restaurant. And we used to go in and ask for oeufs sur le plat, you know, fried eggs. And she couldn't fry an egg. So I once went to her and I said, "Madame, could I show you how to fry an egg?" I took it in there. So after I was frying eggs and getting my eggs free and so on, sitting drinking wine with her when the customers weren't there and so on. But it was very cheap. Food was very cheap and ample. Apples and bread and eggs and meat and all sorts of things. No, no rationing or anything there, you know. We were miles away from the frontier. I don't know, it was just like a holiday, really, that part.
What was the effect of the Normandy cider and wine?
Well, the cider, the wines, a few blokes got drunk, but a lot of them hankered after beer, you know. The only thing I found, Calvados, you know the spirit Calvados? I sampled a couple of drinks of that, and after that I never had any more. Because it was so strong, you know. But the people were very nice to us, you know, and very friendly. And almost English, as far as I was concerned. I found, through my capacity for frying eggs, I had to fight this widow off. But she must have been slightly myopic if she was interested in me, I might tell you. I wasn't interested in her. And